Thank you so much, everyone, first of all, for your patience. My name is Leia. I'm here from Torah in Motion. Thank you for coming to the first class in the series, Beis Yaakov in Historical Perspective. We're pleased to have here Dr. Ilan Fuchs teaching us today. He's a scholar of international law and legal history. He holds a BA in Humanities and Social Science from the Open University of Israel and an MA in Jewish History from Bar-Ilan University. His other degrees include an LLB, an LLM, and a PhD in law, also from Bar-Ilan University. He's the author of Jewish Woman's Torah Study, Orthodox Education and Modernity, and has also authored 18 articles in leading scholarly journals. He currently teaches courses on international law and other law-related topics while maintaining a law practice in several jurisdictions. So Dr. Fuchs, thank you for being here today. Just a quick recap of some upcoming classes before he gets started. Tomorrow, Dr. Ginzel continues her series from the end of the Kingdom of Judah to the return to Zion at 12 p.m. Eastern. On Wednesday, Dr. Lokshin's After the Ten Commandments series continues at 11 a.m. Eastern. Tisha B'Av is soon approaching. Torah in Motion will be hosting an online day of learning for that. Just a note that I will be posting Dr. Fuchs's source sheet in the chat so everyone has access to it, though I think he's also sharing his screen. And while I'm at it, I will also post a link to the Tisha B'Av webpage for those who are interested. So I'm now going to turn the floor over to Dr. Fuchs, and I also wanted to wish him a mazal tov for the recent birth of his child. So Dr. Fuchs, take it away.
Thank you so much. Everybody can hear me okay?
Can hear you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
We'll see if we can see it.
And by the way, we're going to do this about 35 minutes and then questions, correct?
Sure, that works.
Okay, so let me just share a screen so I can show you. We're going to talk a little bit of some source sheets about this topic. Let me see if maintaining a law practice means there's a lot of documents all over the place. And let me see, can you see my source sheet now?
We can see your source sheet. Great.
Wonderful. So thank you so much, Leah. Thank you everyone for being here. First of all, just a little bit about, I guess we're going to have a series of lectures. We're being hosted here by gracious hosts. And there are actually a series of lectures by a group of scholars that deal with Beis Yaakov, beginning with Professor Naomi Zeidman, who is a professor in the University of Toronto, and myself and a group of other scholars from all over North America and Israel that do work on the larger aspects of. Sorry, I muted myself. Mistake. That would do work on this field of.
Can't hear you well.
Oh, let me try. How about now? This is better. So I'm going to maybe just increase the volume. Okay. So hopefully now it's better. So we are a group of scholars. We do work on Jewish women's education and from different aspects. Now, for myself and for this first lecture, what we would like to do is to discuss the halachic foundations of the issue. Now, I guess I'll begin with the very basic question. Perhaps, if you look at education from a panoramic view, why is Beis Yaakov? Why is women's
garbled?
Why is women's education in general? Even an interesting phenomenon in the Jewish section. I mean, don't we all learn all the time? Don't we all celebrate Torah learning? Why is it that women's education captured the imagination and was such a hot topic debate and still is in some circles? I mean, before I continue, maybe one of you would like to suggest a idea about that? I don't know if you can unmute yourselves. Yeah.
Dr. Fuchs, there's some people in the chat are saying that it's hard to hear you, that you're quiet, and there's also some background noise, and I did mute everyone. I'm not sure if others unmuted themselves, but I believe the background noise may be from your end. Is that possible?
No, because I am in I'm in a closed office, so can you hear me better now?
Okay, is one it- second.
No, and I put my computer at maximum volume. So obviously it's, there is an issue.
How about now? Is it better now? Can you hear me better now?
Sounds the same to me, unfortunately. I am going to mute everyone right now just to fix, to see, try to fix the background noise issue. So just Dr. Feeks, if you won't, don't mind unmuting yourself
after I do that. Maybe what Mike, Leo, maybe what I can do, if I don't know, but you'll need to handle me, but maybe if I can call in, that might make the volume better on my side. Could be.
Maybe would you be able to still like stay in this part of the Zoom and be sharing your screen at the same time?
Yes, I could do that. Maybe I'll just call in and you'll make, you know, if you, actually, you know what? I just call, if you see my number, if you can unmute me on my number and I'll talk on the phone and I'll continue sharing my screen. Is that okay?
Sure. That may fix the issue. Let's try that. But stay in the Zoom meeting, okay? Keep you here as co-host.
Yeah, I'm going to mute, and then if you can just open my phone, you can see my number, 561-531-1795. If you can,
yes, I see that. Okay. I'm now asking to unmute that, if you can see that notification.
Okay, can you hear me better now?
How is this, everyone? Is this better?
Much better.
Okay, wonderful.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, the wonders of technology. So let me begin, first of all, just repeat what I said. Again, we're a group of scholars that deal with folks on Besyakov, be it in Europe, be it in North America, be it in Israel, and it's quite a large group of scholars. And I think that in of itself is kind of interesting. After all, in Jewish community, the Jewish tradition, learning is such an important thing, is such a celebrated aspect. It's a given. I mean, it's the center of worship and liturgy, and it's even more central than liturgy in some ways. So the question is this. Why is it a surprise? Why is it a hot topic? Why was it a hot topic in some circles? It still is a hot topic. How come? Why would women learning Jewish sources even be a question? Shouldn't it be a given? And I spent several years discussing this issue in a book that I published a few years ago. But before maybe I go to the sources, the primary sources, maybe one of you can maybe offer an idea. What is so provocative about women having access to knowledge?
Because
you unmute yourself. Yes.
Yeah. Because women were not given access to sources, and in many cases they were told they couldn't have access to sources. And Beis Yaakov, the beginning of Beis Yaakov and what it was and the tshuvas related to it were the beginning of what we now see as the amazing proliferation of learning for women.
Very true. Now, Ms.
Hello?
That's what I heard what you said. Yes.
Yeah, my feeling is that though it's very lauded learning, it was not quite as universal, I think, in general as people may think. I mean, men also worked morning, noon, and night. Possibly took a little time for learning, but I don't think that there was so much learning going on either for men or for women. The inequality might have been for the fact that women's work, they say men work from sun to sun, but women's work is never done. That a woman's jobs are generally almost 24 hours a day, whereas men might actually have a certain amount of time off, and it was felt that the women's priority, my guess would be, was in the realm of what they do.
So these are very
There's another reason.
Yes.
It was accepted, is accepted, that chiyuv limud Torah is upon men and not women.
And therefore, it
was encouraged for men to learn and wasn't encouraged for women to learn.
So when we look at all these questions and so some of the answers you all gave, which are all true and relevant, some of them are sociological, some of them are halachic in nature, and some of them are historical in nature. Now, before we begin, let's say one thing from the historical perspective. Different religious communities have very similar approaches and processes about this question. That's something very interesting, worthwhile remembering. Different religious communities, different traditions in this aspect have a lot of similarities. Something to ponder about. Now, let's talk about what the Jewish sources tell us. Now, some of you mentioned sociology. Now, you all know the famous rabbinic Talmudic axiom, Nashim peturot mimitzvot aseh shehazman girama, that women are exempt from time-bound commandments. Now, within rabbinic literature, and I'm using the term rabbinic literature in the broadest sense, through the ages, one of the explanations for this axiom, for this rabbinic halachic principle, was that it is impossible for women to perform gender roles and to also be bound by time-bound commandments. Now, when exactly does this explanation come about is a very interesting story, but that's not what we're here to talk about. Now, this idea, this principle, was indeed also part of the discussion about women's Torah study. Now, if you look at the first source, it's a source in Kiddushin, in Gemara and Kiddushin, and the Gemara talks about the chiyuv to learn Torah. The Gemara says, and I provide also the translation, how do you know the women are not obligated to teach their sons Torah? The answer is, if you are commanded to learn, you are commanded to teach. And if you're not commanded to learn, you're not commanded to teach. Okay, the Gemara asks, therefore, how do I know women are not obligated? Where do I know that from? Gemara answers now, there's a chiyuv here to teach sons and not daughters. Now, that in of itself is a very, now, Gemara, in the same context, you can see it as a exemption. And you can use the same rationale that some of the sages used for the bigger principle of women are exempt from time-bound commandments. Basically, it is difficult for women to perform gender roles and to also do this. So therefore, the Torah exempts them from it. Now, tell me, let's assume we're taking it at face value. What kind of problems, what kind of difficulties, challenges arise from this approach? Or do you think it's free of any problems? It's not a big deal. We can just gloss over it. What do you think?
Well, it doesn't say that women cannot learn Torah. It just says that they're not obligated.
Excellent. That's first of all. But so that's the first thing. The first thing, from this, we see an exemption. We do not see a mandate, a prohibition. Okay? Now, one more thing. Don't we have an interest in women learning Torah? You would think that if we have an interest in men learning Torah, the same interest we want to increase men's Torah study, shouldn't we increase women's Torah study? What is the difference? Now, in rabbinic literature, and again, we're all staying within the realm of rabbinic literature, we have two directions, two trajectories. The first one, let's go to source number two, the short Gemara from Brachot. Gemara there talks about a discussion between Rav and Rav Chia. He says, Nashim b'mazachyan. Now, it's a part of a larger discussion. What is the role of women in Torah study? And the answer the Gemara gives, Be'akoyai banayhu levei knishta, uve'atnuyei gvarayhu bei rabanan. Which translate, what do they merit? They merit by bringing children to read the Torah in the synagogue, and for sending husbands to learn Torah in the Beis Midrash, and for waiting for their husbands until they return from the Beis Midrash. What's obvious here is that Rav Chia and Rav don't think women should go into the Beis Midrash, or they don't bother to mention that women should go into the Beis Midrash to learn. Again, why not? What is the rationale here? So, this leads us to a primary source, and this is a Mishnah in Maseret Sotah. Now, the Mishnah talks about a ceremony that took place in the temple. What happened there? Women that were accused of infidelity by their husband, were brought to the temple and drank a mixture of water, bitter water. And the Torah promises that the drinking of the water, if indeed the woman is guilty of being of infidelity, will cause a great sickness that will result in death, or if she is did she not commit any adultery, then it will actually lead to a blessing and to more children. Now, the Mishnah and the Gemara discuss a situation in which the ensuing sickness that was mentioned does not result in death quickly, but prolongs over long periods of time, several years. And the Mishnah says because there is a schut, because she has a merit. Now, what is this merit? Now, some merits will cause the punishment to be delayed for a year, some for two, some for three. Now, here comes Ben Azai and says, based on this, Chayav Adam lelamed et bito Torah. Person should make sure his daughter learns Torah. Why? She should know that if she committed adultery and did not, it was not punished immediately, she should know this is not because the Torah is not true, but because there is a merit here that postpones the punishment. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, no. Kol ha-melamedet bito Torah, kiilu melamda tiflut. He doesn't explain what the word means. He just ends here. So we have here a disagreement among Anaim. Women learn or not learn Torah. Okay. In other words, it's according to Rabbi Eliezer, it's not only something he does not feel he needs to encourage, he needs to prohibit, or at least that's the simple reading of this Mishnah. Now, the Gemara only has a handful of five lines on this. It was a non-issue for centuries and centuries and centuries, up until basically late 19th century, early 20th century, on the eve of the establishment of Beit Yaakov. It was not even a question. Now, when you try to look at the commentators, the different commentators, they want to understand why is it, what is this tiflut that Rabbi Eliezer is worried about? Now, the word tiflut, tafel in Hebrew, when you use the word tafel in modern Hebrew, what comes to mind? You know, what does the word tafel mean?
Usually refers to something. I think it means tasteless, like bland.
Very good. Exactly. Bland. So some commentators use this line of thinking to say, oh, what Rabbi Eliezer is worried about is a less than in-depth Torah study. In other words, he was worried that women will learn Torah in a way which will be less intellectual and not as analytical. That's one direction. Another direction, which appears among commentators, the classic commentators, is tiflut as...
Not important. Not important.
I'm sorry?
Not important.
Not important, yeah. And another direction that appears among the Rishonim is promiscuity. If that Rabbi Eliezer is warning that intellectual study will actually lead to cunningness, that tiflut is not so much intellectual tasteless, but it's actually tiflut would be taking words of Torah and using them improperly to facilitate promiscuity. Now, interestingly enough, this is, you can find many, many, many parallels for this in other religious communities. This idea that knowledge leads to promiscuity is extremely popular. You can see it in the Middle Ages, in Christian sources, you can, and it is a theme which we can easily find in other cultures. Now, in and of itself, this is the reality of the discourse within Jewish communities for centuries. Now, why? Now, is it a big surprise? No. When you compare it to other cultures, this makes perfect sense. Perfect sense. Why wouldn't it? If you look at, let's say, the Rishonim period, Jews that live in France or Germany, they look at their neighbors. Men and women alike, do they learn? No, because education is functional. In the Middle Ages, education is based on your function in society. Where are you? Are you a peasant? You need to learn certain things. You need to learn how to work in the field. You are a born of nobility, but maybe the fifth kid or the fifth son, you need to learn how to be a knight. You need to learn how to read and write, for example. You can think of many new nobility that couldn't read or write. Why should they bother with it? Not part of their function. Only in the early modern period, when education stops being functional and we are starting to see the precursors of what we call the liberal arts education, of course, the celebrated by John Stuart Mill and others, we start talking about education differently in a non-functional manner. Now, for Jews, again, even though they have a different perception of education, at the end of the day, everybody around them sees education as functionality. So some of the Jewish discussions of education are similar. So when rabbis in Ashkenaz in the medieval period talk about women's education, they have a very simple answer. Women need to learn what they need to do. You need women to learn how to perform actions connected to their Jewish obligations. So they need to be able to do a fashat challah. They need to be able to have a working knowledge of family purity laws. They need to have working knowledge of kashrus. And that's it. That's it. As the Rishonim, the Maharil, for example, explains, how do you do that? You achieve it by tradition. Parents feed their children. Parents, mothers should feed their daughters. End of story.
Dr. Fuchs, I don't mean to interrupt you. I just wanted to say that quite a few people are still having difficulties hearing you. They're saying you're speaking pretty quietly, and you were hoping if you could speak a little louder so it's easier to hear them.
Okay. Let me try.
Maybe do you have headphones at all, like that you could plug in? that may help.
Well, that is what I tried before and it didn't work. That was the source of the difficulty before. So I'm going to try again. This is better a little bit.
How is that? If anyone can comment, anyone who's having difficulty, I think it was better, but
that is a little better.
Okay. Wonderful. Okay. So as I was saying, when we talk about medieval Ashkenaz, the Rishonim, Maharil, for example, has a very clear idea. Women should learn what they need to do. And in order to achieve that goal, it's very simple. They need to learn from their mothers. That's it. That is Jewish education. Now, it's at least presumably very different than men, right? Because men need to learn even things which are not practical. In other words, men, aren't men supposed to learn everything? Aren't men encouraged to learn zavachim and tahaot, even things which are not relevant to day-to-day life, after the destruction of the temple? Now, that's a stark difference. In other words, the Rishonim create a separation between women who learn in order to function versus men who learn in order to learn, not necessarily for functionality's sake. There's also functionality, but there's beyond functionality. Now, that is a point which is, you can find all across the board. You can find this idea both in Ashkenaz, both in non-Ashkenazi communities, for, again, up until the modern period. Now, maybe the best example is the next source, which is the Rambam. Maimonides talks about Torah study, and he says this. He has the bottom line, which more or less the Mechaber, the Shulchan Aruch, quotes. He says, women need to learn, and what they need to learn is what they need to do. Don't teach them oral Torah. Just teach them what they need to do. Don't teach them all the Torah. Don't even teach them Torah Shemichtav. Although, if you teach them Torah Shemichtav, it's not that big of a deal. The written Torah is not that big of a deal. So, Torah Shebalpeh, oral Torah, don't teach them. Just teach them what they need to do, practical things. Okay. Nobody knows to explain why he differentiated between written Torah and oral Torah. Perhaps he had a source we don't have access to. But it doesn't really matter. This is the way rabbis in the late 19th century, when they want to figure out how should women's education look like, that is what they are looking at. That's what they're thinking about. However, in the end of 19th century, early 20th century, all of a sudden they have a problem. Up until then, it's not even a question. Again, there's a Mishnah, there's five lines of the Gemara, there's a few Rishonim, and that is it. That is it. There's not even a question here to ask anymore. But in the 19th century, Jewish education is facing a challenge. And it's for men and women alike. That's what happens in the late 19th, in the middle of the 20th century, in the 19th century. We start talking about reformation, changes in the Jewish community in Eastern Europe. And what is the main focal point of changes in the Jewish community? Education. We're Jews. It's the Haskalah movement in Western Europe. It's the Eastern European version of the Haskalah movement. And they're saying we need to change many things. But the most important thing we need to change, much more than the liturgy, much more than what we dress like, much more than how our synagogues look like. No. What's really important is to change education. It's true for Western Europe. It's true for Eastern Europe. Now, these calls for change were over a period of several decades successful. Jews started to look for alternatives. of the alternatives were way out the outside the realm of the Jewish community. Some were less so. But they were all looking for alternatives. Now, alternatives. Now, when it came to women, well, when rabbis were talking about how we need to change boys' education to make sure they don't leave, women's education was overlooked. So what do young Jewish women do in Eastern Europe in late 19th century, in early 20th century? They go to, for example, one option is to go to non-Jewish schools. So you can have, you have multiple primary sources that talk about women who go to a non-Jewish school and learn French and learn German and can write beautifully in French and German and can talk and learn sciences and develop interesting careers in nursing, for example. Well, their brothers sit next to them with Pais and learn Gemara and only speak Yiddish. Now, what do you think is going to happen when you have such a dichotomy? Do you think it's going to go well? Because when they go and learn all these things, even if it's an, even if it's not a place that has an anti-Jewish rhetoric, which some did, but even let's say it doesn't. Let's say they were, for example, in Poland, there were certain schools that were paid for by the government, Polish government in the interwar period, very hospitable to Jews. There was no Jewish content there. What's going to happen when you have students who are there and they learn about modernity and modern values? And there is no Jewish education to speak of. The result was very clear. Jewish women started to leave. Now, when I mean leave, it could be in only in rare cases conversion to other religions. Only in rare cases. What most likely happened was secularization. In other words, stopping observing Torah mitzvahs, or to a lesser degree, we have a phenomena of to a higher degree, leaving the Jewish community to intermarry, not necessarily convert, but to intermarry, and even in some cases, leaving, you know, women that, as a result of their education, want to leave Eastern Europe, travel to other countries as a way to break through with the burdens of the past. All these things happen, including, by the way, including also very high rates of trafficking of women, of human trafficking among Jewish women. That was extremely high. And all those things were connected, not just by scholars, but by Jewish leaders during the period, connected to the lack of Jewish education for women. Now, when rabbis realized that, for example, in Krakow, 1904, the first rabbinic congress, the first ever since the Sanhedrin, there's an attempt to bring together all the major rabbis of the world. Hundreds of rabbis go to Krakow and have a meeting, several days. And there's Jewish newspapers from all over the world, and there's pictures, and everybody's there, all the big names, or most of the big names. And they talk about the problems, and one of the biggest problems is, what are we going to do with women, Jewish women? They're leaving us in droves. Again, and the horrors of trafficking in Jewish women in the period, something that lasted for several decades. So what do we do about it? And rabbis are saying, we need to change women's education, but they're being told by their colleagues, hey, you teach your daughter Torah. It's like teaching her tiflut, be it promiscuity, be it just turning words of Torah to words of folly. It's wrong. We shouldn't do it. And everybody's shrugging their shoulders. Everybody's shrugging their shoulders. Nobody's giving an answer. And you know who comes up with the answer? Which rabbi comes up with the answer? Anyone wants to take a guess which rabbi comes with an answer? This may take time because the answer is simple. There was no rabbi. When you look at Orthodox Jewish schools, the change is grassroots. Sarah Schneer. Sarah Schneer comes, does what she does, not because she has, now the story is told after the fact was she had rabbinic support. Truth be told, she started a school, started teaching, created a curriculum. After the fact, when it became successful, she had some kind of rabbinic support. But if you look at the rabbinic support, if you look at the primary sources, the best she could get from the Chafetz Chaim was, yes, start, it's an important thing in this day and age, even though it's, there's a problem with it, a lot of problem with it, I can't do anything about it. So just, we can't do without it. We have to do it. So do it anyway, even though there's a lot of problem with it. Now, the success of, and we'll talk in the next few weeks, you'll hear more about Bisyakov and its successes and its problems. But today I want to continue with the rabbinic reactions. When you look at the success of Bisyakov, it is not because of the rabbinic leadership. The rabbinic leadership joins after it's become successful. And again, the Chafetz Chaim, he doesn't say why it's okay. He says there's no other choice. Therefore, even though it's forbidden or it's halakhically problematic, I can't do anything about it. Now, in this language, it doesn't change. Even after decades of Bisyakov, you can still find halakhic responses to this in Sifrut Hashu'ot, in the response literature, that talk about how problematic Bisyakov is. How the educators in Bisyakov, modern Bisyakov, they teach too much. There's too much knowledge there. You can still find that language. For example, Shushevet Halevi, Volner, talked like that. It was actually a contemporary rabbi in Muncie who wrote an entire book called Torat Imecha that attacks modern Bisyakov. Related to the Satmar circles and celebrates the fact that in the Satmar schools, women do not have access to rabbinic literature. They don't have actual books. They actually don't use actual chumashim. They use excerpts, which are made for them. But women don't have even access to actual sefarim, actual books. Now, we don't have much time, so until we finish in the next 7 minutes, I just want to talk about those rabbinic leadership that did make a change, that saw that something here dramatically changed. And here I have two things. One, within the modern Orthodox circles, where Torah study for women became a something to be celebrated and encouraged, and parallel to men's Torah study. Interestingly enough, when you look, however, on the way it's explained, there's no, for example, of Yosef Soloveitchik, Rav Lichtenstein, in those circles, Rav Goren, in those circles, the religious Zionist circles, while the explanation for the fact that we are supporting here institutions which seem to contradict simple reading of the Mishnah and the Talmud, usually the explanations are on, this is a special era, if you do not teach Torah, therefore women will leave you. So it is a form of et lasot le'ashem afeototech, it is a special time, dangerous time, this is what you need to do. Okay. fine. And as well as that, we are willing to create a whole new curriculum for women that includes Gemara study, in-depth Gemara study. Very similar to that that is done by men. Now, there is one exception, however. That's not in the modern Orthodox circle. That had to do with, I have a chapter in my book that deals with that. And that's the last source I brought for you. That's got to do with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He dealt with the issue several times during his rabbinical career. Even before he became the leader of Chabad Lubavitch, he already started to think about this issue. I found one source from 1947 where he talks about this issue. And he returned to it several times during his tenure. And Lubavitcher Rebbe says, and again, we don't have much time, so I'll give you the short version. He says, I have sources that talk about women that study in order for them to perform. But he's asking, is that all they do? He says, okay, I understand that women are not obligated to learn Torah, but women are obligated to learn to perform the mitzvahs they're obligated to. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe says, you know what? Maybe we shouldn't look at it, he said, so on such a rudimentary level. He says, I'm looking at the Gemara. The Gemara tells me that if women learn Torah, then they become cunning. There's a problem of cunningness. But is cunningness always that bad? Sometimes being cunning can be used for good things. He says, women need to learn to, in order for them to perform mitzvahs. The Lubavitcher Rebbe said, I understand that, but does that mean that's the only thing that's achieved by that? In other words, men learn to do and also for learning's sake. You're telling me women only learn because they need to perform. But if Torah elevates men, Torah will also elevate women. And he brings a beautiful comparison. He talks about, he quotes the Lugachovil, the famous Eastern European Torah sage, who he knew personally. And the Lugachovil talks about a very puzzling Gemara that talks about how a Gentile that performs certain mitzvahs that he is allowed to perform has the merit of a Kohen Gadol B'Yom Kippurim. And he says, what exactly does it mean? The Lugachovil then says, you know what? He says, I have other examples. He says, in Beis HaMikdash, he says, the Kohanim did several things, but several tasks that they need to do when they were bringing sacrifices. It was slaughtering, it was taking the blood, spilling the blood. There was one that was optional. That basically, if you, depending on where you were in comparison to the altar, if you were close enough, you did not need to walk to get to it. Just take the blood, check the animal, butcher the animal, take the blood, throw it. If you were far, you chose to be far from the altar, you need to walk. The Gemara says, if you walk, even though it's an option, all the conditions that are required for the other actions, in other words, to have the proper intent, the proper thought process, also apply to this. So, and the Lugachovil explains, therefore, when we choose to do things which we're not obligated to do, they attain the same level of relevance as what we must do. The Lugachovil Rebbe says, this applies to women. Women, when women learn, even though it's not because of the same obligation men do, I don't care. It has the same significance. He's saying women's Torah study has the same value from a spiritual level that men's Torah study has. Oh, they learn for different reasons? Okay, fine. Doesn't matter. The result is the same result. That's number one. Number two, he says, the vast majority of learning, and this is only can be said by a Hasidic master, and it wouldn't be relevant to the Litvish world, is that we learn in order to be the love, have a sense of love and awe of God. That men and women both need to have. So all Torah study that avails you to love of God and awe of God, well, that doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman, you have to learn Torah. You have to. It's not even an option. When he wrote, he said that several times. In one of the times when he said it, it actually was in the heydays of the battle between Chabad Lubavitch and the Litvish world in Israel. This was actually such big news. The Litvish newspaper, on the first page, just printed this to show how extreme and how unorthodox the Lubavitch Rebbe is. It's a fascinating example. They were truly amazed. They were so amazed. They just put it on there and on the first page. Now, in that sense, the Lubavitcher Rebbe's approach is a unique one. Even in modern Orthodox circles, there's nothing which is quite as clear-cut and clear-cut in support of women's Torah study. Now, just to summarize, it's hard, in my opinion, and that's the book I wrote, the halachic interpretations, the halachic discourse around women's Torah study is probably the best example of the most meaningful halachic revolution in the modern period. Why? Because it required a head-on collision with the traditional understanding of rabbinic sources and demanded a reinterpretation. And as a result, over 100 years later, that reinterpretation actually happened. It continues to happen. And in the next few lectures, myself and Professor Lyman and all the other researchers that deal with this issue will try to show you how this is not only a theoretical issue, but had real-life sociological results. So I'm sorry for the late beginning, but if anyone has any questions, I'll be happy to answer.
I don't understand how there became a difference between teaching women Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh.
That is an excellent question. There is no, puzzled some of the commentators, there's no clear source that we know of that could explain this distinction. The best explanation that was offered by a modern commentator of Kapach was that there was some kind of a source that was lost. That happens sometimes, you know, that were sources mm-hmm. recorded in the Lishonim that we don't have access to. That is his best guess. There is no source that we have that explains this distinction between these two.
Also, one more question. Is Torah Shebaal Peh taught in Lubavitch girls' schools?
So, very good question. In the chapter I wrote, I was talking about the theory. There were some cases of this happening, mainly in post-secondary schools. Today, for example, in Crown Heights, there is a program, a very elaborate program, but I have about 30 or 40 participants, and they learn Gemara in depth. In the secondary education, what you would see is not so much in depth oral Torah study, but Hasidic treatises, which are studied. Which, by the way, according to this definition, the classic definition is quite prohibited. So, but again, that is the venue that the Lubavitch Girls' Schools took. Again, introducing quite intense Hasidic treatises with strong Kabbalistic inclinations, not so much the study of Gemara. Although, again, you can see that in small circle, in small programs, in Grand Heights and some other places.
Thank you. I guess I had one other question. In the Middle Ages or up until more modern times, were women expected to be literate in Hebrew, like for tefillah, or were they just generally illiterate and only learned how to run a Jewish household, a religious household?
It's pretty clear that the primary sources do not require the mandate that promote women's operating knowledge of Lashon Tefillah. Now, are there women who do know? Of course, yes. But there's also, multiple primary sources through different centuries and different communities where it's pretty clear that, on a general note, many women have no command of the Hebrew language, which explains, of course, the evolution of the Tchina literature in the late medieval period, early modern period. Tzenarena being an example of an evolution of that literature that allows women some kind of somewhat of a access to the primary sources to one degree or another. But I would like to add one more thing. There's also many primary sources that make it very clear that women, men who had the major strata of Jewish society who had no serious command of the language, without a doubt. No serious command of the language, and they might be able to pronounce the words, but have no functional usage of the language. In other words, they pronounce the words, but have no idea what they're saying. That, again, is corroborated by many primary sources.
Dr. Fuchs, I would like to let you know that I sent you two questions in the chat, private message them to you that a participant wanted to ask.
Okay, so here we go. Is there a reason that even in Lubavitcher girls' schools that there is no learning from original sources of Gemara Mishnah? Okay, so that's a very good question. Now, that's something that I might, I might want to deal with in the future. I was actually looking for a graduate student that might be willing to do more work on it. My findings, which again are quite simple. In Lubavitch girls' schools, there's a choice to be made. Remember, in America, Lubavitch girls' school all over the world, there is a secular studies curriculum. Almost all of them, by exception. Even the exceptions actually have secular studies, they just delay them a little bit more. But when it comes to choosing what the time you have, what to teach, they made a choice to teach Hasidic treatises rather than Oral Torah. That is quite clear. There's no doubt about that. Now, that takes time. In other words, to teach these sources seriously, be it Tanya, be it, Hasidic treatises from the different generations of Lubavitch literature, that's a significant time. That's a very significant curriculum. It is hard to see how you can integrate Oral Torah, secular studies, and Hasidic to curriculum. It's just simply not enough time. And that's pretty clear. Now, that as far as this question. Another question I see, what's the reasoning for keeping girls from learning what their brothers are learning? Now, the reasoning was, as it exists in the Middle Ages, is women when Rabbi Eliezer says tiflut, he either, if I can turn it into, again, use the way the Rishonim understand it, he is referring to one of two things. He's referring either to promiscuity, that intellectualism will lead to promiscuity. Again, not a unique approach, a very common approach among, you can hear this kind of, as early as Aristotle, by the way, has this kind of rationale. The second option, women are not analytical enough. Again, classic Aristotelian reasoning. And therefore, they should learn classic Aristotelian reasoning. Now, that's the way this rabbinic thing is understood in the Middle Ages. Well, the next question is, okay, so is this really at the core of rabbinic literature? I'm one Mishnah, 5 lines of Gemara. Now, the fact that education is the face of education changes only in the modern period. In other words, moves from being functional to non-functional. Means up until then, it wasn't even a question. Again, education is functional. You learn what you need to learn in order to perform your societal roles. If you're born into a certain family, into a certain gender, you have only several things you can do. Okay, let me give you an example. In the medieval period, you're born into a peasant family. I'm not just talking the feudal period, even though afterwards. You will be a peasant. What you need to learn how to do is very simple. You need to learn how to work the land. You were born into in a family where your father is an artisan. You need to learn this skill. Again, it's not only the feudal period, also afterwards. The rationale is, why teach women to do things they don't need how to do? Because you only learn things you have to do. Who learns how to read and write in medieval Europe? Monks. Again, we have the primary sources, famous primary sources. King of France, I forget it was Charles IX, he can't read. He can't read. He can't read. He can't write his own name. Why should he bother? There are people in his court that that's their job. His job is to win wars. So he learned how to be a knight, how to lead armies. So that is the rationale. Learning is functional. The issue is this. When it comes to Jewish sources, there's one exception. Men are required to study because it is a mitzvah to study for its own sake, even when it's not functional. That is a unique idea, which it's very hard to find parallels to. By the way, even in other religious communities, it's very rare. There are some Islamic ideas which are similar, but definitely medieval. Talk about Christianity. There's no direct parallel to that. Far from it. So here is really the dichotomy. When you tell me to be close to God in Judaism, you have to learn Torah. Oh, but women only learn Torah in order for them to perform mitzvahs. How can they become close to God? That is the difficulty. And that difficulty becomes very, very poignant when there are more educational options in the modern period. Then this becomes an issue. Then this becomes a problem. Because again, if you don't help them create the Jewish identity, it's not going to be a vacuum. They're just going to go somewhere else. And that is what happened. Assimilation based on gender, that's the work Paula Hyman did in the 1980s. That's where the crux of the matter was. There was a direct correlation between lack of Jewish education and the creation of a Jewish identity among women and assimilation. There was no doubt about it. And you did not need Professor Hyman in Yale in the 1980s to tell you that. Again, rabbis in the period say that. They see the results. And that mandates an answer. And again, the answers, it's difficult for the rabbinical leadership to give an answer. Again, what you saw today, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, that's the exception, it's not the rule. And again, it took such a revolutionary figure with a very clear vision of Jewish identity and and the needs for Jewish identity in the modern period to say something like that. That's why he, you know, he has such a unusual explanation for the sources and such a revolutionary interpretation of them. It's not something, again, it's not a big surprise that someone like him, with his agenda and stature, is able to say that when hardly anyone else is. Any other questions?
Okay, if there are no more questions, we should be wrapping up.
I have one question.
Of course, of course.
Do you think that the principle of mitzvah tzaseh shezman grama, which limits women, do you think that's an explanation of reality? Or do you think that it actually formed halakha? Elizabeth Shanks Alexander considers it to be an explanation rather than a cause of the practice. What's your opinion about it?
Well, it's a very good question. It's a very good question, and that's the question which there's no primary sources that will give you a direct reference to this. So what I like to say is that this is the same sociological reference is at play here. What do I mean by that? That the sociological references to Nashim Ketuvot and Mitzvot Aseh Shezman Grama, that is exactly what is at play here. In other words, the idea that there are gender roles, and gender roles are in education is, and religiosity is connected to gender roles, and therefore women's Torah studies also, because it's functional, is connected to gender roles. If the gender roles don't require knowledge, don't give knowledge. Now, and that's very clearly, in my opinion, part of the discourse in the early rabbinic sources. Now, just one thing. The only exception is that Jewish sources at the same time celebrate learning for its own sake. And that creates a dichotomy. When the dichotomy gets to the forefront in the modern period, well, here we have a problem. Here we have a problem.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
Yeah. And I see there's one more question I got here in the chat that, first of all, that what happens between the Tanaim and the Philos is a long period of time. Now, you're right. There's a big difference. There's a long period of time that differentiates. But when we look at the rabbinic sources and how they're understood, in the early modern period, that's how they understood. In other words, you only see changes in the modern period. Again, very clearly why? Because now there are options. Now there are options as far as education outside the Jewish community, and that is the reason. We always see women who are exceptional. Always, always, always. But that's how they are explained, as exceptional women with exceptional talents. Historically speaking, there is no systematic attempt to change the value of women. My book discusses that element, how this explanation of the extraordinary women is really a way to placate things and keep things as they are. But in reality, to keep the status quo. In the modern period, there's a need for something else. Either you say all women are exceptional, or you need to rebuild, or you need to offer a different explanation. And most rabbis said, okay, in our generation, all women are exceptional. Or, like the Babbage Rebbe did, we need to reread everything. We need to read all these sources in a new way. Now, see if there's another question here in the chat. knowing what we know now, that women aren't inferior, what is the justification for women not to learn what men learn? Now, so let's talk about two different, again, this is a broad stroke. So in the in some parts of the Jewish world, if we take a look at Lubavitcher Rebbe in the modern Orthodox circles, there is no justification. In other words, women are, the Lubavitcher Rebbe makes it very clear, women must learn. Now, they need to learn what will make them better connected to God. So he doesn't say, okay, they have to learn Dashemi. That's not the issue. The issue is learn Torah in order to better connect to God. What you learn, we'll talk about it later. But that's your goal of learning. Modern Orthodox circles, I think they will be used again, different verbiage, but the idea will be a very similar idea. Within the other spectrums, well, they would probably fight you on this issue. They will continue to, again, to use this language of Nashim Da'atan Kala and so forth. And this is why this is such a fascinating topic, because this touches at the core of everything. This touches at the core of what we are all about, the way we understand modernity, Yiddishkeit, in Judaism in the modern context, and the role of rabbinic leadership in interpretation of rabbinic sources in the modern period. This is what makes this such a great test case, because you're dealing with head-on with the basic question: are we living in a different world with different values and different understanding of the world, and what does that mean on the way we understand classical Jewish texts? And I think this is the last question I got directly. So is there any other questions?
If it's all right, Dr. Fuchs, we do need to be wrapping up soon. So I just wanted to thank everyone for coming today. Dr. Fuchs, thank you for your amazing shiur, and apologize on behalf of Torah in Motion for the technical difficulties that occurred during the class today, the audio issues and the beginning. Thank you for joining us, and I hope everyone has a wonderful day.